I'd like to call to order the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development. Let me start off with an announcement. Today, we will not hear House Bill 2154. We will not hear House Bill 2640. We will not hear House Bill 2692. And House Bill 2747 will be carried over until Thursday. We will have a public hearing. We'll have a public hearing on these bills in this order. Public hearing and or possible work session on House Bill 3079, House Bill 2898, House Bill 3075, House Bill 2386. Let me open up a public hearing on House Bill 3079. If you could give us a summary, Richard.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3079A requires all institutions of higher education operating in Oregon to provide students with fact sheets regarding educational value, school performance, and financial cost prior to enrollment. It regulates advertising and solicitation of students by institutions of higher education, and it specifies standards for data and rates provided. It requires an annual report to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and it declares an emergency effective on passage. The committee has been asked to consider the -A3 amendments just drafted today. The -A3 amendments make some changes aimed at targeting accessibility and making some clarifications to the text of the measure. And the A3 amendments also remove the emergency clause and move back some of the start dates for House Bill 3079A.
Okay, thank you. And this is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. And Representative Dembro is here to talk about this bill with the -3 amendments.
That's right, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Haas, members of the committee. I'm Michael Dembro. I represent House District 45, Northeast Portland, out to Park Rose. And House Bill 3079, as Mr. Donovan shared with you, has to do with reporting information that we believe students need to know if they're going to make intelligent decisions on where they're going to go to school and how to invest their hard-earned dollars, and if they are going to have to go into debt in order to invest in their education, what that debt amount will be, what it will cost them, what their, you know, just what is involved before they make that commitment. This bill is actually a combination of three different bills. There was a bill that I had, a bill that Representative Johnson had, and then another bill that a group of us had, all trying to get at this issue in slightly different ways. We put together a work group that included representatives of universities, community colleges, a variety of for-profit college stakeholders, in order to try to bring these three together and to come up with something that that would work and that would do good. And I think that we have pretty much gotten there. The reason that these last set of amendments only came today is because, you know, it's difficult taking several bills and putting them together with such a, you know, a diverse stakeholder group. I think we're close. There may be there may still be one or more little technical amendments. LC did their best. They may not have gotten it exactly right that I believe we can deal with in the Ways and Means process. There's nothing really substantive involved with that. It calls for every student who seeks to attend an institution will be given a fact sheet with the information that is laid out in the bill. The HEC will, through rule, help with the actual process of how this information should be gathered and will be presented. The HEC will, on its website, include a master site where a student can go. Let's say a student wants to go into welding, for example. So they can go to this site and they can see the various options that they have for welding programs in their area. not knowing how you feel about the healthcare exchange, I'll say it's kind of like the healthcare exchange in that sense, in that it will, the goal is to allow a student or their family to be able to compare apples to apples, public school, private school, you know, private independent, private for-profit, and to be able to make the best decision that they can. That's really what we're talking about here. The institutions will have a year to put these things together so that they'll be available for the 14-15 academic year. And it's, you know, again, this was a bill that, you know, in this form is the result of a very aggressive and ambitious work group process. Be happy to answer any questions you have.
Senator Robin?
Yeah, the other one I have is if you're still concerned that you aren't maybe narrowly right, is this something we could put off till February? It would still be ready pretty much if people knew what they were moving towards for the start of the 14-15 school year. Or do you think it's close enough now that it's...
I do. I do believe that it's close enough. Okay. I think, you know, it's gone through a lot of work. It may be that, you know, as the HEC goes through its rulemaking, it will come back to us and tell us, hey, we need the statute changed, you know, because we feel our hands are tied too much. And then we can address that in February. But I think it's really important. You know, originally this had an emergency clause, and it was going to go into effect in January. But getting this started right away is you know, I think important. And we'll having the rollout next July, I think, is important.
Senator Beyer.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I'm just reading through here. Is there... There doesn't appear to be a definition of Institute of Higher Education. No. Who does it apply? I mean, are we referencing something else someplace? I like the concept.
Yeah.
I was hoping it applied to all of the public schools as well as the professional trade schools.
It does. It, you know, I'm not... I'm just looking at the amendments here. But you know, it does... it applies to... all the institutions of higher, public institutions of higher education, you know, plus those that we call the independent colleges and universities, those are the nonprofits, as well as the for-profits that are overseen by the HEC.
I see it. It's in Section 7.
Okay.
Yep.
Representative, what's the gist of the changes in the dash threes from the previous version?
Again, you know, to a large extent, they're kind of technical. There was something in there that would have prevented a school in an earlier draft, that there was something that would have prevented a school if their default rate on their student loans was above a certain amount, that they would be barred from operating in Oregon for a year, and another that... where if they failed to comply with any of the provisions in this bill, they would be barred from operating in Oregon for a year. That seemed a bit extreme. And to be honest, it wasn't clear how we could enforce that, certainly with our public institutions. And so those really, those found their way inadvertently into the bill, and so they needed to be excised from the bill. It also, these amendments give the HEC more latitude in working. So it says that institutions, the intent is institutions are reporting, are going to include in these fact sheets information that they're already reporting to the federal government. We have a goal of trying to make this as, you know, non-arduous on the institutions as possible. So to use as much as possible information they're already reporting to the state or to the federal government. Well, those requirements change over time. And so we wanted to make sure that the HEC had the flexibility to adjust the expectations to comply with changes that were in the federal, what was being reported to the federal government. So just to give them some more flexibility.
Okay. We had an indeterminate fiscal report when it passed the House.
Right.
It's now over here, it's amended, but it now has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
That's correct.
So there's just some things you can't explain in life, I guess.
You know, they're indeterminacies.
Yeah.
I did want to say, though, you know, that I think this is really good stuff for people to look at, but I will tell you that I have had many students in my career who I explained that it would probably be good to have a backup plan that rather than being a professional athlete or a rock star.
Really?
They still pursued that goal. Don't know that any of them have succeeded yet, but that doesn't mean that they won't. So, you know, you can put all the information you want out. Having people really internalize it and decide is sometimes a really good thing, because sometimes we hurt people's visions of what they want, and we kind of diminish their chances to go do things that they'd really like to do, but the information says they shouldn't. On the other hand, reality is also a really good thing to have some grasp of. So I guess I understand it's mostly just information to give them so they can look at it themselves and make their own decisions from, but you worry at times that it might also, education's a good example, they might look and say, wow, I'll never pay off my loan this time, but I really want to be an educator. It may have intended and unintended consequences as we move forward.
Right. Yeah.
They passed me over on the NFL draft for several years.
No, I wasn't entirely about you, but it is partially.
Yeah. Senator Hass and Senator Roblin, you know, let me say that, you know, there are many people out there who would like us to be doing more regulation and more control of our institutions in order to deal with this problem of student debt. Right. We decided that really the best way to approach this, at least at this time, is let's have transparency. Let's try to make things as much as possible apples to apples so that students and their families can see, you know, clearly, you know, do I want to choose A? Do I want to choose B? What are the benefits, you know, to this as opposed to that? So at least we're creating the playing field. So that it's as clear and transparent as possible. More than that, it seems like it would be hard for us to do.
That's right.
Okay. Any questions? Okay.
Thank you,
Representative. Anyone else wish to testify on House Bill 3079?
Sir. No, then the next class page.
I can slide up.
Okay.
Yeah.
For the record, my name is Professor Russell Dondero, Emeritus, Pacific University, Forest Grove, Oregon, 1506 Olympus Lane. I wasn't aware that this piece of legislation was up before the committee today, but I want to echo what Senator Roblin said as a fellow educator, also as a parent, which I'm sure all of us, many of this room are. We all know that in higher education, and I represented as a faculty member at Pacific University for 31 years. But toward the end of my career, I also taught as an adjunct professor in the Hatfield School of Government in Portland State. And I went to the University of Minnesota for my graduate degrees and Whitman College for my undergraduate degrees. So I've had a lot of experience in the education realm of higher ed. We know that nationwide, it takes the average student at least 6 years to graduate from an undergraduate college experience. And given the nature of the way the state of Oregon is now planning on the 40-40-20, and currently many students who are going from high school to community college to a four-year college, it's quite likely that the four-year, five-year, six-year graduation time is going to expand. And so I'm glad to hear in the bill, in the conception of the stakeholders, there's not necessarily a regulatory function here. It's more information and giving students and their parents a clear vision of, okay, here's the track record of Pacific or the U of O, OIT, or a trade school. That's all good, and information is important. But as I want to echo what Senator Roblin said, both in terms of my own two children who are college graduates, One took 5 years because of illness. Other took 10 years because of bad decisions. But they both graduated from college, and both are serving in their professions. But we all know as parents that our kids often don't listen to us, and they make good and bad decisions. And I don't think a school of higher education or of any sort should be held accountable for the decision-making by young people in their 18s to 30s. And so I think if the purpose is information, it's great. If the purpose is regulation, then I have serious problems, but I gather it's not regulation. So I think, you know, the more information we can get out to parents, to students, to counselors, the better it is. But frankly, higher education, as you all know, is a very competitive marketplace, particularly between public and private universities, and I'm sure it is between community colleges and trade schools. So in some sense, we often say we believe in the marketplace. Well, I think the marketplace has served us very well. But if it's information, then absolutely no problem. Let's hold everybody accountable to providing that base of information. But let's realize that there is no guarantee that in showing the information, they're going to act upon it when they're 18 years old. Hopefully by the time they're 30 or 31, they will figure it out and they'll graduate accordingly. Anyway, thank you for your work.
Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3079A and open up a public hearing on 3079A.
How about if you open
a open up a work session on 3079A to move this to the Ways and Means Committee. Senator Cano.
Well, Mr. Chair, do you want to adopt amendments?
Why don't we adopt those dash threes?
All right. Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the dash three amendments dated May 28, 2013.
Senator Knoop moves to adopt the dash three amendments to House Bill 3079A, dated May 28, 2013. Is there discussion? Seeing none, objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3079A as amended to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Knoop moves House Bill 3079A as amended to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. House Bill 3079A moves to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Close a public hearing on 3079A.
Work
session is closed on House Bill 3079A. Let me open up a public hearing on House Bill 2898. If you could remind us, we've got a couple of components to this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2898 allows students with a disability to earn credit at community colleges or public universities as part of transition services and prohibits the denial of financial aid to a student for the sole reason that the student did not receive a regular high school diploma. The committee has two sets of amendments, the dash ones and the dash twos. The dash ones relate to community colleges, and it gives community colleges doing a program in public safety training and or curriculum development the right to have a facility on ground that is otherwise zoned exclusively for farm use. And the dash twos alter the district boundary petition process for changes relating to school district transportation. The committee previously heard the dash one amendments and the original bill on the 23rd of May. This is the first time the committee has considered the dash two amendments.
The dash twos are the identical language to Senate Bill 600?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The committee previously considered Senate Bill 600, which has the same language as the dash two amendments to this bill.
Okay, and so we're in a public hearing, and Representative Unger is here to speak to the amendment. Representative.
Senators, Chair, Hass, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ben Unger. I'm the state representative for House District 29, which serves the wonderful communities of Hillsborough, Cornelius, and Forest Grove. I support the bill that's before you, House Bill 2898. It's a good bill. I got to vote for it in the House. I wouldn't be here, though, if it was just for that bill, although it's a great bill. I'm here to talk briefly about the Dash 2 amendments. I hesitate to say I'm speaking on behalf of some other of my colleagues who wanted to be here, but there were a number of us who wanted to be here, but for a, from a time perspective, I think I might be the only one who addresses you today. These amendments represent almost identically the bill, Senate Bill 600, which you considered and voted on previously, and you passed unanimously, and it passed relatively overwhelmingly on the House, on the Senate floor. I wish I would have been there then to tell you the things I'm going to tell you again here now, but I've always had concerns about this bill because it directly affects a bunch of the community members and students that I serve. This bill, when it comes right down to it, the Dash 2 amendments that are before you and what previously existed at Senate Bill 600, as a boundary battle. Where shall the boundaries be drawn to best serve our communities? That's the question, I think, before us. I think it's a difficult question. I believe that over the years, especially in places like Washington County, where we've seen over the last couple of decades our communities grow together, we're dealing with this issue in a way that we haven't had to deal with before. And suddenly new developments are going to be slotted into certain school districts, and other school districts want those places, and then we get legislation to decide who wins. I submit to you that this discussion is bigger than just one or two school districts. I think the bill's before you primarily because Hillsborough and Beaverton have a disagreement about who ought to serve students. Hillsborough certainly currently serves those students. Beaverton would like to. I think it's a bigger discussion than just two school districts, and I think it would behoove our respective bodies to allow us to have a broader discussion about what to do as some of these communities grow together, because it isn't just this one plot of land. The amendments before you in the Dash 2s would actually potentially affect 23 different plots of land around the state. We haven't had those discussions about what will happen to those different school districts. There are plots of land out in Washington County that Hillsborough would love to serve, that probably makes sense for it to serve. But right now the boundary doesn't allow it. In the House, we've been having this debate in a relatively rigorous manner. I'd love to continue that debate and have some opportunity to come up with a long-term solution that will work for the entire state. I submit that might be the best course of action. So I urge that you adopt the original bill, House Bill 2898, without the Dash 2 amendments to allow us to have that discussion further. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you for testimony. I appreciate you coming up with you're one of the more thoughtful leaders over in the House side, and we appreciate your help on this bill.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2898, and I will go into a work session on House Bill 2898. And we're going into a work session on 2898.
Okay.
Senator Canope.
Do we have ones and twos?
Yes.
Ones and twos.
You want them both? Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments stated May 23rd, 2013 to House Bill 2898.
Senator Canote moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2898 dated May 23rd, 2013. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated May 24, 2013 to House Bill 2898.
Senator Canote moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2898, dated May 24, 2013. Is there any discussion? Hearing none. Is there any objection? Hearing none. So ordered.
Chair Hess, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking action on House Bill 2898 without having a fiscal impact or revenue impact statements at this time.
Senator Canote moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking action on House Bill 2898 without having the fiscal impact and revenue impact statements on hand at this time. Those of the opinion the rules should be suspended for the purpose of taking action on House Bill 2898 without having the fiscal impact and revenue impact will all say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion carries and the rules have been suspended.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2898 as amended to the floor with a new pass recommendation.
Senator Knope moves House Bill 2898 as amended to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Senator Byer.
Aye.
Senator Cruz.
Aye.
Senator Roman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Knope.
Aye.
Chair Hass.
Hass votes aye. The motion passes. House Bill 2898 moves to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. I will be the carrier. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2898. And we'll keep moving our way down the list. And open up a public hearing on House Bill 3075A. Administrator Donovan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3075A reduces the frequency by which the Department of Education collects information related to physical education. The committee has been asked to consider one set of amendments, the Dash A7s. That revises open enrollment law regarding criteria for admission, and it alters bus route reimbursement procedure, restricts the use of state school fund and local revenue money expenditure for advertising purposes, and encourages students considering a transfer to finish the current school year in school of current enrollment. This is the first time the committee has considered this measure.
And we have a Dash 7 amendment that does what to this? Is that what you were going over?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
All right, that's a Dash 7. Morgan Allen from the OSBA.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, Morgan Allen here on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association in support of both the underlying legislation in House Bill 3075 and the addition of the A7 amendment. So I'll briefly describe the underlying bill and then get into some more details about the A7 amendment. So the bill that came over from the House is the 2013 edition of mandate relief. And as you know, Mr. Chair, over the past two sessions, this committee and the legislature have passed several mandate relief bills that have eliminated duplicative reporting and some of the outdated and burdensome mandates on our school districts. So we had three more that we wanted to bring forward this year. Those are in the underlying legislation, House Bill 3075. The first piece in that bill is that it eliminates some duplicative reporting about physical education facilities. Districts right now are required to report each year their square footage and facility needs for PE. This bill changes that so they would only need to update that report when they build a new school or modernize their PE facility. So it would get rid of rote, basically turning in that report every year. The second thing is there's a statute that probably predates certainly the internet and possibly computers that requires school districts to keep written policies of their personnel or written copies of their personnel policies in every school library and office building. So we're changing that to basically say you can put that on the internet and print that out when people request copies. And then the last and probably the most important piece is Achievement Compact submission deadlines. Right now, Achievement Compact advisory committees are required to submit reports to school boards on February 1st, and the subsequent Achievement Compacts that school boards and districts enter into with the Oregon Education Investment Board are due July 1st. One of the things we've learned as going through one cycle of Achievement Compacts is that the student achievement data does not come out until the summertime. That is, particularly OAKS testing data does not come out till the summertime. So when our school districts, administrators and teachers and school boards sit down and try to set goals for the upcoming school year, they don't have the most current student achievement data. So by changing this date, they would have the most recent available student achievement data in order to set those goals. So that came over to you from the House on a 59-0 vote, and that's the underlying bill. And I'd like to talk about the A7 amendment. And I just passed it. There's a one-pager that should be coming around that I think many of you have already seen copies of. So the A7 amendment makes some adjustments and fixes to the open enrollment law. But before I go through this, I want to make it very clear that this amendment is only crafted to apply to open enrollment, so it doesn't interfere with transfers or tuition or some of the other issues that your committee has been considering. And the amendment does not place a cap, a limit, attempt to repeal or change the sunset date or take any other action to eliminate the current open enrollment law. I think that's very important for the committee to understand. These amendments are meant to make adjustments to the law that are consistent with the legislation that was passed in 2011. The amendments have no impact on the transfer rights of current students or prospective students who may be looking at open enrollment as an option. But the amendment does try to deal with some of the unforeseen outcomes that have been identified in the 2 years since we've had open enrollment in place. So the first issue on the one pager I sent you is, and I think the name implies open enrollment, that means if you're going to open up your school district, you're going to take students when you have space from whence they come. Unfortunately, the way the open enrollment law was drafted, it allows districts to set geographic boundaries on where those students come from. So for example, Mr. Chair, if the Tigard-Tualatin School District decided to open up their boundaries for open enrollment, they could say, we'll take students who would otherwise attend Beaverton High School, but we want to take students who would otherwise attend Aloha High School. And so we want to make sure that there are no geographic limitations. That is, you can't say we're going to take open enrollment kids only from a certain school district or a certain community or a certain neighborhood or a certain capture area for that neighborhood school. If you're going to open up your boundaries, every student that would like to have a shot at those openings should be able to do that, not based on where they live. The second issue that comes up under open enrollment, when a student goes to a district under open enrollment, so for example, if I live in Albany and I were to go to Corvallis under open enrollment law, I become a resident student of the Corvallis School District for purposes of ADMW and all the other rules and regulations. But I always have the right to come back to Albany. If I go to Corvallis and I have a family situation that means I need to come back home, or if this is their bullying situation, or I just realize it's not the right fit for me, I always have the right as a student, wherever I live, to show up the next day at my neighborhood school, whether I'm in a charter school, a public school, I'm homeschooled, or I've transferred or open enrollment. You always have the right to go to your neighborhood school. This amendment does not deal with that. But there has been some concerns raised that when students have come to districts under the open enrollment law and found themselves in a spot of trouble, perhaps facing a disciplinary issue, that it has been suggested to those students that maybe this discipline issue could be avoided if you just went back to your home district. We think that's absolutely inappropriate. So we have some language in the bill that would prohibit school districts from, as a condition of discipline, you know, suggesting or otherwise asking students to leave the district because they are residents of that district. That's the second issue. The third issue is around school bus transportation. In the original creation of the open enrollment law, this was very explicitly in the bill and very explicitly discussed, that the idea was if you lived outside the district and you were going to come to that district under open enrollment, that you would be allowed to ride the school buses of that district within the boundaries. That is, if the student or the student's family could get them to a bus stop, the district that enrolled those students under open enrollment would be obligated to transport those students on their buses within their district boundaries, and they would be allowed to receive state school fund money to do that. Unfortunately, there was a loophole in the law, one specific loophole that allows school district buses that leave a district boundary that have open enrollment students on them to collect state school fund dollars to transport those students. That was not the original intent of the law. So there's an amendment that would prohibit school districts from being reimbursed for those miles traveled outside of their school district if there are only open enrollment students on those buses. That was not the intent of the original law, and we believe this change is consistent with what the legislature intended when they passed the law. The last issue that has come up as well is that some school districts have engaged in, I think, what would be fairly described as advertising or marketing of their open enrollment programs. Now, that's appropriate. If you want to have an open house in your district, you want to print some brochures and have them available at your schools, put something in your local newspaper, put something on your website, those things are absolutely appropriate. But what we've seen is more things along the lines of direct mailers into neighboring districts with information about open enrollment in an attempt to recruit students. We have an amendment that would not prohibit this practice, but it would prohibit the use of state school fund dollars to pay for those types of advertisements. Again, we don't believe that money that the state and local taxpayers send to school districts to go to the classroom or to improve educational outcomes for students should be used to prepare marketing materials to be sent into differing districts. So those are the four changes in the proposed -A7 amendment, and I would be happy to answer any questions about them.
Thank you. Senator Roman.
Thank you. So state school fund monies could not be used. Does that include local property tax?
Chair Haas and Senator Robin, the way we crafted the bill would include local revenues like property taxes or timber receipts. Essentially, the idea is that public monies would not be allowed to do those types of marketing activities outside your district. So if you wanted to put up a banner in your community celebrating your district or your open enrollment program, you could do that. But you couldn't pay for a banner in the next town over. Or if you wanted to put a newspaper ad, you could certainly do that, but you couldn't put a newspaper ad in the next town over. You could certainly use it with private money or PTA money or foundation money. Obviously, we can't regulate free speech, but there's certainly precedent where the legislature tells school districts what they can and cannot spend their money on, and we don't think that's appropriate.
Senator Robin.
Yeah, another question. I just wanted to put it on the record because I don't want to forget this. In the underlying bill, there is an issue with respect to the number of minutes that a person has to be in PE, and Morgan and I have talked offline and believe that there does need to be a fix for that, but that we are not ready. I've thought about it a lot of different ways, and the issue is when you have three-day weeks and five-day weeks, the way it's written, it just says every week you're going to have X number of minutes, and that would make a lot more PE one week and less PE another week. Most of the time when we talk about minutes, we talk about longer terms, so you can actually average it out. And I've tried to figure out how to do that for elementary and middle school, and I think we will have some minutes for next session to take that. Those don't go into effect, and I think, until 17. Right. So we have some time to fix it.
Like with Thanksgiving week or something.
Correct. You only have 2 days. Yeah. Does the whole kindergarten just do PE for the whole 2 days before they go to recess?
Although Thanksgiving week might be the week they should do that.
We all know that.
The week after.
We all know that physical education is really important for mental acuity and for kids learning anyway. So I think we all agree on that. It's just the amount and working it out so that you can average it over the time that it needs to be averaged out so that people can have a reasonable expectation of how much PE they're going to do instead of.
Well, thank you for raising that issue, Senator Roblin. Well, as you know, that's the Senate President's package, and we'll have a conversation with his office, and we certainly have some time to fix that. Mr. Chair, one of the other things I just wanted to make mention to you was that the amendment before you today is brought to you by OSBA, COSA, OEA, Stand for Children, OSEA, and a whole bunch of school districts. So this is something that we vetted and had some discussions. We certainly understand that some of the folks out in the field have disagreement with some of these provisions, but we believe that there's overwhelming support from the educator, teacher, school board, administrator, and parent community for these changes. And we'd urge you to make them today.
Okay. The issue on marketing, how prevalent is this? You mentioned billboards in other towns, advertising, come to our school, it's better than your school.
Mr. Chair, it's an excellent question. Unfortunately, there's no way to quantify how many dollars may have been spent on that, because it's not something that school districts report to the Department of Education that somebody tracks. I do know from testimony in the House that one school district that you may be hearing from spent somewhere around $10,000 on a marketing campaign. And certainly I have seen examples that school board members or other folks have shown me of direct mail type letters. So we're probably not talking about more than perhaps a few $100,000 maybe statewide. But again, we believe that's not appropriate use. That's not what that money is going to the districts for.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Allen, I want to explore a little bit the issue of open enrollment and how it works today and how this possibly might change it. So would I be correct if I said that under open enrollment today that there are districts who have reciprocal agreements with other districts? In other words, they'll open their enrollment to students in that district if the other district will do likewise. Does that happen today?
Mr. Chair, Senator Knope, that's an excellent question. That is a separate issue. That is related to interdistrict transfers. It's a little bit confusing because, as I've talked to the chair about this, there are actually six different ways that students can attend school in a district outside of their residence. And what you describe is a not uncommon practice under the current interdistrict transfer law, okay, but is not allowable under open enrollment.
Okay. Thank you.
I know parents are confused about the nuances of open enrollment versus transfers, and as we discussed before, there's about six different ways to do that, and it just feels like there's no reason for all of that complication, and that somewhere, maybe in the interim, we come up with some more streamlined way to essentially align all of these rules so that it makes a little more common sense. There's nothing quite so complicated.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, it's an excellent comment. As we've talked to both proponents and opponents of some of the various bills around tuition transfers and open enrollment this session, I think it would be appropriate. And I think OSBA is going to try to put together a group in the interim to have those conversations, because it is confusing. It's confusing for kids. It's confusing for parents. It's confusing for school districts, because all they have different rules as far as deadlines. Some of the pathways, both districts have a say. Some of the pathways, one district has a say. Some of the pathways, residency transfers and FAPE transfers. Other pathways, it does not. So we probably need to bring some consistency to those at some point.
No, I was going to say that. It's exactly the problem. I mean, sometimes when open enrollment, that person is actually transferring everything, all the rights to go to that new school district, as they do in the agreements like you have talked about. They are not a resident of that district. They are still a resident of their home district, but it's an agreement that they go back and forth, and the money actually goes to the home district and is transferred to the – I mean, it's very, very convoluted kind of system, and we need to figure out how to organize it better.
Okay. Thank you. Mark Thielman.
Thank you. I'm Mark Thielman. I'm superintendent of the Alsea School District, and I'm the district Morgan was referring to that might be speaking in opposition. You know, a couple of things, and not to disparage, you know, obviously I'm kind of standing alone here, and I have a good relationship with members of some of these same organizations who are kind of supporting these amendments in terms of modifying open enrollment. So what I wanted to do to come up here, obviously I don't want to, I'm a little bit of a David versus Goliath mojo here. As I want to just let you know a little bit of how we've approached open enrollment from an Alsea perspective, and in hopes of bringing a different perspective to the same thing that might help you guys with some of the confusion that's out there, because there definitely is. I mean, in general, it's really about inclusion versus exclusion, and we don't want to do harm. And in our little district, the way things existed before is a lot of our best and brightest went to the large district. If they had socioeconomic means to drive, because it's 25, 30 miles in any direction to the nearest community from Alsea, those kids had an advantage to do so because the districts that received them didn't provide busing. So when open enrollment was passed in my school board, we sat down to do goals. We talked about what can we do to stop the declining enrollment, and this law was right there, and we thought, wow, we better go great guns, because and we better generate results, and we better use data, and we better be able to communicate it so that we can attract kids, because, you know, it's going to be some really choosy parents who will want to put their kid on a bus for 30-mile bus ride every day. And when we said we want all kids, because we looked at what the open enrollment did, and really it was an issue of residency, so I'd like to introduce that to you guys. And the ORS 327.006 defines what a resident student is. And open enrollment was, from my understanding, and the 2011 session when I was asked by various legislators to give input, I talked about how nice it would be if public schools were allowed to compete with charter schools, because we're getting creamed. Charter schools can do open enrollment year-round. They can bust with impunity. And the thing that gives them the right to do that is part of it's the federal issue and the state laws that were passed in relationship to that, but is the issue of residency, that a charter student, wherever they might live outside the regular district's boundaries, especially if it's a chartered district, is treated like residents. They are become a resident. So the definition of residency, from my understanding, and the way that our school board and our school district approached this issue was based on that. And it's defined as, it's very similar to inter-district transfer. So there's two ways to be a resident. You can live in the district. The district can take legal responsibility for you, and that has to do with some of those FAPE things and things that Morgan spoke to. All of that's correct. The other way to do it is through an inter-district transfer. And the definition for that is under a little section B, section 7B here, whose legal residence is not within the boundaries of the district reporting the pupil, but who attends the school district with the written consent of the school district board. So the resident district gives permission for that child to go to a neighboring district or some other district, and that's considered that student, the money follows that student. So residency has to do with where does the money follow. And when a district receives the money, they're taking responsibility for the education of that student. These amendments challenge that concept. They're trying to make an exception, not for charter schools, but only for open enrollment, but not for inter-district transfer kids. And it speaks to the very confusion that you were referring to, Senator Haas. I'm a little bit at a loss to see where this stuff is coming from in terms of what we're trying to accomplish with these amendments. We're a 150-kid school district. I did a lot of talking over the last week when this stuff came to my attention, and when I brought up issues of residency, I didn't get any clear response from any of the members from the groups that I'm a member of. And it's not that they didn't want to give me a response, it's just kind of a new thing into the ether there. So I'm in a little bit of a quandary. If open enrollment kids are considered resident kids in the law, the written permission is granted not by the resident district in the case of open enrollment, it's granted by the legislature. So I just have an issue saying, I can't come get you. The other piece is, the reason we bus in LC, one, it's geographic, because we got these mountain ranges between our town and everywhere else. But two, it's also that we don't want kids who maybe can't afford to drive to not be able to come to our school if they, parents, feel that their child might benefit from what we offer. Now, I've testified in many situations on the results. That's not the purpose. I'm here. Repeatable, impressive results. We're trying to build a proficiency-based school system. We have our own self-standing preschool. We have an extended day program. We have all-day kindergarten. We teach kids to read. And but what I want to introduce too is, and it's kind of my last piece, is this concept of transportation equals equal access. And equal access means for all kids, socioeconomic, geographical, you know, you name it, all the classes. And so the problem with equal access is that sometimes it costs money and sometimes it's not overly efficient. But it's an extremely important part of the whole purpose of public schools. That's why they were set up. So an example of, and then it also smacks to advertising. I need to be able to advertise. Now, if we don't want me to spend school funds on that, I can live with that. The problem is I'm an 800-person community, 1,100 if you count all the ranches, and we're already taxed with having to help sustain our own freestanding preschool. So it's not 10,000, it was 8,000. And the question is, what is that $8,000 by the state as a whole? And I can tell multiple stories. I'll share one quick one because I had permission from the parents to do that. A little child named Joe sent out brochures. Mom saw the brochure, was not having a good experience with Joe in kindergarten in an area district. She came to our open house. She thought, boy, this sounds like a better situation for my son. Signed him up for open enrollment. Within a few months, she ended up moving into LC. So then he was an open enrollment. Problem is, it's expensive to live in LC with the gas. So she had to leave at Christmas time. Her child went from kind of chronic behavior issues to in the top reading group in the kindergarten class by Christmas. They had to move. They moved a couple districts over. She called me 3 weeks ago, just at a loss, saying, looking to move back. What can I do and how do I do this? Because the child went and he was so far ahead reading-wise, they had to put him in the first grade reading group, but behavior-wise, kind of back to being the way he used to be. Now the question is that child being served? Larger systems, it's tougher, but we catered to that very contingency. So, but in our district, the child had no behavior problems, and hence the mom's willingness to try to find a way to bring the child back. And I'm not disparaging our neighbors, because believe me, we've had our failures. I'm just not here telling you about them. But in the case of that child, open enrollment created more service, especially to the underserved. And so I want to introduce those things. I mean, I accept the will of the process here. I do not want to create lasting rifts between the very organizations that have done so much to help my school district. I understand where they're coming from. I guess what I'm trying to say is, in our case, we're a model of inclusion, not exclusion. We're not stealing kids, we're salvaging them. And we're not big enough to be a threat to any of our neighbors who are all bigger than we are. So I just hope for a little bit of discretion in that. I will say that number one and number four, in terms of the geographic, no geographic boundaries, we would support that because we also do online with Insight, and we kind of created an open issue, and that would make my life easier and a lot less paperwork. So that would help us. And then the last one is the discipline issue. You know, I can see that. I don't think that's an appropriate way. So I would support, at least on my list, what would be number one and number four. But number two and number three, I see that as an intrusion. If I can't tell people about it and I have to raise the money and I can't go get them, how do I honor residency and how do I serve the underserved?
Well, do you, Mr. Thielman, do you advertise now? Do you send it? You said you send out brochures.
We do. We do a direct mail.
And that's paid for through your...
Yeah, it's part of our district. See, the school board wants, we set three goals, and then we decided to shape the budget to fund the goals.
Well, I think so. A lot of us, when the legislature created this law, it was one thing for a family to say, I want to throw in with this other district across the river, and I'll deal with whatever I have to do. I don't know that we crossed the line and said we want districts to go out recruiting for other families. And I think that's what we're, you know, I have some discomfort with doing that, mm-hmm. especially if it's with public money. I just have problems with it in any sense because I see there's a lot of problems.
Well, I can Senator relate, Senator House, I can relate with that. But charter schools, public charter schools, get to do it with impunity. And so it goes back to fairness. Can we level the playing field?
Yeah, we'll look into that because I think some of the public charter school stuff that's done advertising-wise is not paid for by the public charter schools, paid by others.
Some of the advertising, yeah. And like I said, if I could probably live with the advertising piece if I had to pick. The busing one could be problematic in terms of...
So the busing one that I have a concern with is that there has been a movement in our state for the last 8 years to do away with busing. Currently, the formula gives you 90% if it's done for educational stuff, and a number of groups are out there saying that there should just be a lump sum so we can do with it as we wish, because some districts, large and otherwise, don't do as much, and they could shift that to the classroom, and others could do different kinds of things. Those of us in rural areas have a hard time with that because the kids can't get there if you don't have busing. So,
yeah.
So we fight to maintain the other one. I am concerned that if we start going outside of our own districts to do it and it's still paying at the 90%, very quickly you will find that the group of people decide that, oh, we're just going to do a basic funding and you're going to get X number of dollars because your district is so big. Here it is. That's it. Do with it as you wish. I worry about that a lot, and I think that, you know, maybe you can talk to your other districts and work out ways in which they transport to a certain area and then you pick them up from that area. But right now, you can make some weird things. I mean, we did away with, we used to get reimbursed for education transportation for our sporting events. But some of us who have had 125 miles each way for sporting events, they didn't like paying that bill. So we did away with that. So it's not paid at the same rate any longer. And it makes it a lot harder for some of us in rural areas to compete because the transportation cost is still there. We still get our kids there. And so I worry about this a lot, and I've thought about it a lot, and I think that we were very explicit last time when the conversation was going on that it wasn't to provide transportation to those kids. That, yes, it was your student, but no, parents were going to have to, if they made that choice, they were going to have to get their kids to the border, and once they got to the border of your district, we would transport them. And I think we were clear about that during the conversation about the legislation, and I think this is a surprise to people, and the cost of transportation can go up, and that can create another problem. And I'm not saying that with 120 kids and no matter, you're not transporting 120 all the way, so it's not enormous with you, but it's one more check in the conversation about why we shouldn't be funding education and transportation.
You know, and just for clarification on that, I'm in agreement with everything you're saying. The problem is we do allow inter-district transfer kids to be funded, and we do allow charter schools. And so what makes an open enrollment student different?
So do you transport inter-district transfer students? Because we don't.
Yes.
Most of our districts do not do that. We have believed that inter-district transfer, it's still the parents' responsibility to get them to the border, and once they get in there, we'll transport. But most districts that I know don't pay for transportation for inter-district transfer students other than special needs kids, and that's going to happen regardless because that's a federal requirement.
Sure. But again, it's the discretion of the school board, and in our case, it makes economic sense to do so. And we, in exchange for that commitment by the state, we have worked hard to generate repeatable results educationally. And that's where, you know, that's kind of the intent of the law. And so what I'm saying is, you know, fair is fair. It's either the same rules for everybody or we change the rules.
Yeah, I have no
I did idea. Get a call and was asked about the lump sum thing. The problem with that is it creates that discretionary issue where people suddenly, for various reasons, get underserved or they don't get access. And so the reason that the system was set up is because of that equal access concern. And it was done so knowing it would cost a little more. But it's obviously a very functioning system. I can tell you, we did not add a bunch of routes. We extended some routes. We have all three regular, interdistrict, and open enrollment kids kind of woven in. And the reason is we don't have the economic engine to buy buses to expand routes. So some of this is self-limiting.
So one other follow-up. So if you had a student in Portland, you would transport them?
No. I mean, it wouldn't.
What point do you say to them, you're too far?
Well, there's a couple of ways that, and these are nuances. Sometimes districts, if they have a child way out in a rural area and they don't want to pay the expense of riding a bus, the state says that we can pay that parent mileage to drive in and meet. For Portland, I might go that way, but I still don't think that, I don't think there'd be a lot of, we haven't been very competitive in Portland. I think there's other people closer there.
After hearing the results,
but
they should
but
be.
But you never know.
That's right.
So what I'm saying is that geography and some of the limits in the system itself are self-limiting. The bus replacement is still a logistical cost. So we don't have the engine that allows us to just have six, seven routes. We just don't. So I guess what I'm saying is, you know, we don't have good data on this, and we're about to make decisions based on spurious data. I asked at the SUPS meeting last week, you know, in legitimate questions, how many districts are busing? We don't know. What's the cost? We don't know. You know, Morgan spoke to that. But we're passing these policies. So I understand the intent of open enrollment, but it doesn't change residency. And residency rules are what drive the funding formula in transportation. And so that's all I'm saying. You're putting me in a little bit of a quagmire.
Right.
But I'll do as you say.
Okay. Senator Crowe.
Thank you. How many districts do you guys pull from in terms of open enrollment?
We pull from, one, two, three. And I shouldn't say that. We've expanded. If you include, you want online or just physical bodies. We have one that comes all the way out of Fern Ridge, which would be, I believe, Bethel. And that family drives all the way. The dad works in Albany, and they meet the bus. And she's been remarkably successful.
That's a long drive.
We take it as a compliment.
I absolutely should.
You know, so maybe four or five, but you know, we're okay. We're just here to meet the needs of kids, and I also sent five of my students to the neighboring district, and we were able to relax a little bit instead of having stress about releasing some kids because we were able to bring in some more, and it helped make that reciprocity a little bit better. And again, we're not the perfect answer for every single kid. We think we're the answer for more versus less, naturally. But, you know, if we got a student that's into dance and that kind, we do not offer that. It behooves us to give them access. We've even offered bus service if they choose. You know, they have to catch the bus when it heads out. It'd be early, but they could do it. And so, you know, that's the way we've approached it. It's all about inclusion. It's all about serving. And in particular, serving the socioeconomic needy and giving them equal access. So.
Okay. No further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Yeah.
Anyone else here today on House Bill 3075? Well, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3075 and open up a work session on House Bill 3075A and see if we can add those amendments. Senator Canoe.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the dash 7 amendments to House Bill 3075A, dated May 21st, 2013.
Senator Canoe moves to adopt the dash 7 amendments to House Bill 3075A, dated May 21st, 2013. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Chair Hess, I move that the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking action on House Bill 375A without having a fiscal impact or revenue impact statement at this time.
Senator Knope moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking action on House Bill 3075A without having the fiscal impact and revenue impact statements on hand at this time. Those of the opinion that the rule should be suspended for purposes of taking action on House Bill 37 without having these impact statements will say aye. Opposed,
aye.
Say no.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3075A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Yeah, okay. Senator Knope moves House Bill 3075 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Byers.
Yes.
Senator Cruz.
Aye.
Senator Roman.
Aye.
Aye.
House votes aye. House Bill 3075A, as amended, goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Senator Roblin will be the carrier.
I will.
Okay. Close the work session on House Bill 3075A. And now, last but not least, public hearing and possible work session. I'll open up a public hearing. I will open up a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2386. If you could give us a quick summary of the bill and the amendments. And Rep. Barnhart is in the building.
He was just here.
And Senator Close is also making her way through here. Go ahead and give the summary first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2386. Prohibit school districts from requiring students to wear, carry, or use an item with radio frequency identification devices if the device is used for the purpose of locating or tracking students or taking attendance. That is a notice requirement in the case of the student possessing property with such identification device. Declares an emergency effective 1st of July of this year. The committee has been asked to consider the Dash 2 amendments, which change the bill and establish standards for guidelines regarding notification, use, and privacy protections of any radio frequency identification device used by schools.
Okay, Senator Close. We're looking at the Dash 2 amendments to the original bill that was sponsored by you and Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The Dash 2 amendment I would like to support. I'm Senator Betsy Close. Pardon me. I support the fact that the State Board of Education should go forward and adopt guidelines on this issue. I understand we don't use these type of tag identifications right now, but other states are doing so, so I think that's an appropriate thing for the board to take up. My concern was student privacy, which the bill addresses, the amendment addresses, and that there should be an opt-out. And so I'm happy with this compromise.
The Dash 2 is just simply say, if you're ever thinking of doing this, let us know. Questions?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We'll stand in recess for a moment and await Rep. Barnhart.
By the state,
Chair Haas, members of the committee, thank you for taking my testimony. Becky Strauss on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. I testified in support of this bill initially and have just had the opportunity to look at the amendments today. I don't want to do anything to stop the trajectory of the bill. I think it's a good concept and it sounds like there was a good compromise with the amendment. I just want to raise a couple concerns. My first one being, I think it's a language thing that might be able to be tightened up if there's time. Section 1 talks about if one or more school districts submit a request to the board, it triggers the guideline process. But that seems to assume that there's a requirement that those schools go to the board for permission, and I don't think there is. And so I think the intent here is to put in policies for use of student tracking technology. But with the language, it appears to be that schools could go ahead and do that boundless, and if it would only be if they happen to go to the board requesting the guidelines be put in place, that those guidelines be put in place. I think that's counter to the intent, but would love to see that there. Otherwise, I think the idea of parents and students having the opportunity to opt out is the idea of what we're going for. Would love to see some provisions around retention of data that's collected or sharing of data that's collected. And if that's going to stop the progress of the bill this session, would be happy to come back in the future and try to tighten that up if there's an opportunity later. And similarly, in Section 2A, talks about guidelines that must protect student privacy, ensure security. I think we want to make sure that we're talking about, I believe the intent there is to talking about ensure the security of the data as opposed to ensure the security of students, and maybe security of students is another provision, but typically when we talk about privacy and security, we're talking about the data itself. Thank you for the opportunity to flag those things, but otherwise think it's a good bill and hope to see it move forward. Thank you.
I think that's a very fair point. It does almost begin with assuming that you're doing this.
Yes. Well, Mr. Chair, it assumes that this is, if a school district was going to do this, they have to tell the state board, and I don't think they have to tell the state board. So we're assuming that there's a permission required that isn't. Can we get a read from our certified smart people in the back?
Cindy Hunt, Oregon Department of Education. I kind of agree with the conversation. The way that I'm reading this is that if a school district chose to require a student to wear one of these devices, they wouldn't be prohibited under this. They could choose to approach the state board to adopt guidelines. But when I see the word guideline as opposed to rule, guideline to me is permissive. This is a best practice kind of a thing. Whereas if the bill used the word rule, then it's like you shall do this. So what the state board would adopt, presumably, if a district approached the state board, would be kind of a best practice. This is what you should be doing under this.
Senator Roebling?
Yeah, and my other concern, I agree with you on the security, meaning partially data. But the reality is, I think another big part of it is, if you were able to hack in and know the issue, you'd know exactly where the student is all the time. And that could be a personal security as well, with respect to somebody wanting access to where that child is. Which would scare me maybe even more. So I think it's both securities.
Further questions?
I'm just wondering, Mr. Chair, how long it would take Cindy to fix this?
Not in that line of work anymore, but.
She still knows how to do it. She could give a. I mean, I Becky's right on this. There's some holes here that I think are unintended.
We have another meeting left, so why don't we?
Right, that's what I'm thinking. Maybe we can take another look at this language and get it more right, just to fill that hole. I mean, making reference to the state board when nobody has to report anything to them and they don't have any jurisdiction doesn't really.
And if I may, Chair Haas and Senator Cruz, I think absolutely, and it doesn't seem like from what I can tell that there's disagreement around that intent. I hope that there's time to do that, and just some language issues rather than opposition to the substance.
Yeah, we'll get on it. I think Senator Close can work with you and get it fixed by Thursday.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
No, because we will have a new amendment.
Anything else, gentlemen? Then I will close the public hearing and work session on House Bill 2386. That clears our agenda. And we will be carrying over 2386 to Thursday, our very last day. Thank you. We are adjourned.